Recently, the Irish group here in the city had their immersion week down in Tamworth, and one of the Irish visitors who was participating in the immersion week and was teaching Irish is Therese Ruan, and Therese hails from Castlebar in County Mayo. The Falter Road could you know Rogella Conchar Chinneke Shark Knee Therese?
Gurmila Margot, Tashi Intoch Vehen Shark Kahimera.
I was Honey Tugji, Canada, Mar Vito Munchor, or Singueltot.
Tashi Shafir, couple blame of him, Vime Egg in Edge of Gale, Shark Horse of Gale Gata. Le Janev e Chechonel Dunagal agus wool me la Arald McGillicanny and Shin agus vishi goni aradam vishi I goni aradam you know tries a well you know in facial chat hig gaelta Canada gafflin you know vishi jungle lum agiriesha gutochen an agus imlina hocker me right chocker me an agus one may answer to us and shocked and chimera, agus vin being this mona caigadini, a bunch part, so shocked and honig misha, vimisha, a monu railga, a fan of shocked ach, even witch and orangana, we galore, ruddy agus okadi, agus ruddy kirdlin, agus ruddy alir shul, agus fisha shock a hint of rinname, this mo dowsa. No, my rhythm is real. Misha Polo. August Freshen V. Cairdlina is Besha and Kator, Marhampla, Honik May, and Ottawa set down on step dancing.
Okay.
It's a shot on similar fad. August V. It's arch on simule. August is concap on simule. Grafager, Gaeltocht. You know, ni Corgameach on Gaeltocht in Aaron. It's Fager, Gaeltocht, Avonu. You know, Kibe Arch, August, Gwil, you know, Tan Kotog Shah had done a lot of larger, because Tashi Gavin is training, August, one may an salt us, August, hug Kaimirog or hug on Funyav, August on Sim, August on Kaijong Hilga, Makata an art Kaijon or Fad, I could just mojin Zini, because she curses her inward on Kaimirog, August, you know, talking to you on Funyav, done con. No, Gaelga Kirk and Kinney in Aaron, Kai May Raw, Chapter Loalia.
Now, we now do need to switch to English, and that is because my listeners, in order to be able to keep up with what was just going on, I'm chatting here with Therese Ruan, and Therese came and visited Canada this year to participate in the Irish Immersion Week that was happening in Tamworth, and she was part of the teaching staff. So, Therese, must have been an interesting and new experience.
Absolutely. I have to admit, it was a fascinating experience. I met Harold
McGillicanny.
Yeah, McGillicanny, a few years ago in Donegal. And every year he's been asking me, you know, will you come out to the Canadian Gaeltacht and teach or support us or, you know, come over? So I always intended to, but never got around to it. And this year, actually, Harold and Sheila, his wife Sheila, came and visited Mayo. And we organised an information evening. We organised a hill walk in the Gaeltacht in Mayo, the Irish speaking area. And I said, okay, I'll come out this year. And I have to say, it was an amazing experience just to witness it,
mm-hmm.
and to feel part of something,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to contribute and support it. So it was a great experience. I met wonderful, wonderful people. And there was more than 50 people that took part in the lessons. But it's not just about learning the language,
mm-hmm.
it's about the culture as well. And it's about, there was lots of workshops. And I have to say, I learned an awful lot.
Right.
As I said earlier, through Irish, I don't think I've ever danced so much
right.
in a week.
No, you were mentioning that, you know, that you have the Irish-speaking areas in Mayo. And there is, of course, in Galway and Donegal and Ring and the little pockets in Meath. But Gaeltacht areas in Ireland themselves, they're nearly an area of preserve at this stage, as distinct from something or areas that are they self-sustaining?
Well, I mean, as you said, there's lots of different Gaeltacht areas in Ireland that still speak Irish as a first language. It's an organic, you know, it's organic, it's been passed from generation to generation, but it is in crisis, and particular Gaeltachts more so than others. Some are quite strong, and other Gaeltachts are actually getting stronger. There's a very strong Gaeltacht, official Gaeltacht in Belfast now, for example.
Right.
Gaeltachts in Connemara, Donegal, and Kerry are still quite strong. But, I mean, I'm from Mayo, and I feel very strongly about the Mayo Gaeltachts. We have three Gaeltachts in Mayo. We have Turvacady, we have Carahaig, and we have Achleim up in North Mayo. And they are in crisis, there's no doubt about it. And I suppose over the years, I mean, the way Irish has decreased, and I speak in Irish as a first language, it has, through emigration, it's always in the poorer areas like Mayo, that young people are emigrating, and then the language isn't lost. But also it has been associated in the past with, you know, the Buchtonus, Caltonus, mm-hmm. poverty, with mm-hmm. loss, that there was a massive language shift where we're losing it. But at the moment, the Mayo Gaeltachts are in crisis in particular, and within a couple of generations, unless, you know, they won't survive as an organic first language. But it is getting stronger in other ways.
And yes, as you say, I understand it is getting stronger in other ways, because there are quite a few Gaelscoil now.
That's right.
Right across the country, not just in the Gaeltacht areas, but I think I'm aware there's at least one or two in Dublin and various other areas. So, and people, it's no longer a stigma, as I understand it, it's nearly something to be sought after to go to Gaelscoil.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, for example, in my hometown, Castlebar, the Gaelscoil, you have to book your child in as soon as they're born. It's full every year.
Right.
And that's the same in most towns. There's one in most towns now, I mean, right across the country. The one thing that is lacking is Irish medium secondary education, or high school, as you'd have here. But that's something that has been worked on slowly but surely. You know, we need more manscullin, as we call them in Irish. But right up through the years, there's always been a positive attitude to Irish. Irish people care about Irish mm-hmm. language. On the whole, you have mm-hmm. people who don't, obviously, but on the whole, they do care about it. They'd like to speak it fluently.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of people feel they've had a negative experience of it, as it was drummed into them at school. And whereas the Gaelscoil is it's really popular, and you know, children learn the language normally, like, you know, in a natural way.
A short while ago, I showed you a little book that was from the 1950s. You're probably a little surprised to see the efforts that were being made back then, even by the Irish government, to try and encourage the Irish language.
Yeah, well, at the turn of the century, for example, there was very few Irish speakers outside the Gaeltacht areas. We had strong, you know, within Gaeltacht areas, but within the government and within, there was very few Irish speakers. So there was an act, once at the foundation of the state in 1922 and 23, we actually had to teach Irish to people. Teach it to teachers, mm-hmm. because the aim was to have education to Irish and to have Irish, you know, to you know, and in some ways that has been very successful, because most Irish people, actually, they've learned at school and they speak it. They mightn't think they speak it, but they do speak Irish. But the Gaeltachts are dying. And
actually, one of the things I would have to say is that I have been particularly impressed, particularly over the last 10, 15 years, when I've gone home, in certain areas, how comfortable the younger generation are. Not all, because I couldn't speak in terms of them all, but in areas where they seem to be able to slip quite comfortably into Irish. And I know there was one occasion we were in Galway, and we heard this, and it only was after saying, we were saying, they're speaking Irish. It wasn't that there were foreigners on holidays, it was they were speaking Irish.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because we, myself and a couple of others, we set up it's just a social night through Irish on a Wednesday night in the local McCarthy's pub in Castlebar. If you're ever there, pop in, and it's wonderful, because it's informal, you know, and you can just drop in all different levels or whatever, and then there's a music session on at the same time or afterwards. And it's now become known in Castlebar, oh, sure, that's the night. And loads of people are fascinated, and they come in, and the group is growing all the time. But it's like that, that's Cúnya Gaeilge, there's the Irish corner. And so but people are interested and want to learn, you know, want to use it more.
Well, you mentioned there that there's sessions on Wednesday nights in Castlebar. And you know what, you and I are now going to take a little musical break. And it would be a shame in doing that we didn't put something on from Jerry Carty, and I know you came across Jerry. He's a good Castle Kinbarra man. Recently, you met him for the first time.
I did, yeah.
The music scene in Castlebar is quite strong.
It is, yeah, and it's actually getting stronger. There's always been a lot of musicians and singers from Castlebar. It always has a strong tradition of it. But there's more live music in the town now, more traditional music throughout, you know, and it is getting stronger. But there is a strong tradition there, yeah. But Jerry McCarthy, he's a legend. And I know his friend John Hoban very, very well, a very good friend of mine. And John said, "You guys, you have to come. When Jerry's home, you have to come and listen to him." And I had the opportunity to hear a session that he was playing in and singing in there recently. And it was, he's a gifted.
Well, I think what we'll play is one of Jerry Carty's tracks. It's called "The Road to Drumlemmon." You probably know where Drumlemmon is, do you? No,
I don't, I have to say.
And that's from Jerry's CD, The Hurling Boys. You are listening to the Gaelic Hour here in Chin, 97.9 FM, and we'll be back with you after Jerry Carty and "The Road to Drumlemmon."
Oh, the springtime has come to Drumlemmon again, and the lark sweetly sings o'er the green fertile plain. And I'll take the road that is sweetest to me, the road to Drumlemmon that winds to the sea. For I've made many friends there on every green mile, and the folks always greet me with a wave and a smile. If I spend all my days there, it's happy I'll be on the road to Drumlemmon that winds to the sea. Well, we sat round the fireside when winter winds blew, and we laughed and we sang till the night was well through. Then we'd have a good dram and a wee cup of tea, for the road to Drumlemmon that winds to the sea. Oh, the springtime returns to Drumlemmon again, and the lark sweetly sings o'er the green fertile plain. So I'll take the road that is sweetest to me, the road to Drumlemmon that winds to the sea. Oh, the long summer days when we tramp the hills o'er, to spend hours at Enon's or Craigan's wild shore. Oh, the soft summer twilight made shadows to flee on the road to Drumlemmon that winds to the sea. All these days passing swiftly bring changes, I know. And as time passes on from this place we must go, but I'll always remember as the heart beats in me the road to Drumlaban that winds to the sea. Oh, the springtime has come to Drumlaban again. And the lark sweetly sings o'er the green fertile plain. So I'll take the road that is sweetest for me, the road to Drumlaban that winds to the sea.
Welcome back to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM. We're chatting with Therese Rouen, who's in Ottawa visiting from Castlebar. But we didn't tell you earlier on, Therese is also a member of Castlebar Town Council and is a founding member of Mayo Intercultural Action. And of course, Chin being a multicultural radio station, I couldn't help but ask, tell me about Mayo Intercultural Action and what's that all about?
Mayo Intercultural Action. Well, I was a teacher. So I taught for a secondary level or high school for about 12 years. Then I gave up teaching and I did a master's in intercultural studies in Dublin. And then I decided, I think it's time I wanted to move home to Mayo. And that was 2002. And at that time, Ireland was really changing. I mean, the ethnic makeup of Ireland was really changing. It was very visible. It was happening very quickly and overnight. So I moved down to Mayo and what I met was a different Mayo, it was changing, as I said, but also there was what we call direct provision hostels or institutions for keeping asylum seekers, and there was three in Mayo at the time. So myself and Geraldine Mitchell is her name, we started to visit the hostels and we started to, you know, talk to the people, and we realised very quickly that, well, first of all, their needs weren't being met, but also they were based in a very rural place.
Mm-hmm.
They had to live in hostels, very poor conditions, overcrowded, they had no choice but to live there, and a lot of them had been there for 3, 4 and, you know, 5 years, and these were set up as a maximum stay of 6 months for mental health reasons. So there was lots and lots of issues. And I just felt, I mean, I've travelled the world and I just felt really, really strongly, you know, we need to do something here. Mm-hmm. We need to provide some support. So that's what we did. And we got around the table. We brought together a group of people and we set up an organisation. So that's mm-hmm. how it started. Now, since then, it has evolved into a much bigger organisation. The organisation Mayo Intercultural Action works with migrants of all, you know, we work with asylum seekers, refugees, migrants, economic migrants, you know, people on work permits, etc. And we provide support to them. But the other thing that became evident very quickly was that Ireland had become really ethnically diverse very, very quickly. So what we found was the likes of the council, the health service, the education service, they didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
There was no extra support put in place by the government. There was
mm-hmm.
nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody, you know, working with organisations, working with service providers to try and meet the needs of migrants or meet the needs of the local community or to promote integration. So we realised, we decided, okay, we applied for funding and we got money to do a baseline study or do research on the needs of migrants but also the needs of service providers in the area. And, I mean, it was such an ambitious thing to take on as volunteers. But we did it,
mm-hmm.
and we produced a report that became every other county in our, you know, other counties started to replicate it when, and Mary Robinson came to launch it for us. And in fact, Mary Robinson has been a supporter and has visited Mayo Intercultural Action on a number of occasions to provide support to the organisation and has backed us to the, you know, to the full, which has been great. It's given us a lot of.
No, and I know it would be fair to say this. You mentioned, you know, Ireland changed culturally very, very rapidly, and you know, we live very much in a multicultural society here in Canada,
yeah,
and in Ottawa, that has grown and evolved. And even with all the safeguards that are in place, there are tensions, and there always will be. The Irish, for the Irish, the multicultural change that happened must have been difficult for a lot, because it's happened so rapidly. And the traditional Irish mentality and psyche was, we are just us, and people leave here, people don't come here.
Yeah. I mean, Ireland was all, and particularly a county like Mayo,
yeah,
it was a county of emigration. You,
yeah,
left. And we weren't accustomed to people, particularly from diverse cultures, coming, you know, to live. I think, and I can be quite, I can be very critical, because I think it's my role to be at times, but I think overall we did quite well, considering,
mm-hmm,
you know, how it did change so rapidly. But I suppose what I was meeting was so many people falling through the cracks,
yeah,
that had that needed support, that needed service, and those services were never put in place by the government,
no,
and still haven't been put in place. I mean, one thing that, even simple things like an English language, you know, a national strategy to teach English,
yeah,
to migrants coming in, because of course they need to learn English.
Yeah.
Our integration programs, how our systems work, that was never provided. So we as an organisation, I suppose we filled that gap,
right,
and we did fundraising and we got grants and we, you know, we provided that service. So, but as an NGO, I suppose that's quite common in Ireland as well, that the fact that community organisations come together,
mm-hmm,
set up, and like we have official status as an NGO now,
right,
and all that. But in the long run, it's not sustainable. So, for example, we did get funding. The HSE, which is the health service in Ireland, have given us a free office. We got funding for a project to promote employment for 2 years, but with the cutbacks now, that funding has been cut.
Mm-hmm.
So I do all this voluntary at this stage. There's 5 staff in the organisation who are on different schemes, you know, working on different schemes. I manage the project, but yet I've no job.
Right.
So I still do the same job,
yeah,
voluntary,
yeah,
full-time job. But that's not sustainable.
No, but the other side of it then is it's a lot of times when a situation like this happens, the focus is always there on the immigrant, because they are arriving into a strange culture for them. But given the scale of immigration that happened in Ireland and how Ireland changed, was any thought given and were any programs put in place to assist the Irish,
yeah,
in adapting to the change,
yeah,
and were they availed of it?
You see, they weren't, and I don't think we addressed that. As an organization, we identified that as a need from the very, very beginning,
mm-hmm,
and that integration is a two-way process,
mm-hmm,
and that, you know, the host of the culture and the host society needs to learn, you know, and needs to know, well, what's all this about, and how can we, and what, and oh, is this going to take over, and are we losing our, you know, there's all those fear, you,
mm-hmm,
know, and unless the proper information, and unless there's programs and integration programs in place, you know, you've all myths and misinformation out there that. And that, you know, that's not healthy.
No,
it's not healthy,
no,
for promoting a sustainable.
No, and the other issue, of course, is, and I remember I was talking to Brother Crowley up from in Dublin, that runs the soup kitchen up,
yeah,
there, and he said that one of the problems he encountered was that a lot of the migrants are immigrants who were coming looking for assistance. First of all, they had a real issue because, in their culture, to actually beg for help and ask for help was something that,
yeah,
they found difficulty. But then they were unable to communicate in English, and there was nobody on the support side able to understand. And he also raised the issue that, of course, within the Garda, that if there were incidents, that,
mm,
there was no one on the Garda side,
mm,
who was in a position to communicate in many cases with non-nationals.
Yeah, and that is a huge problem, and that's still a very big problem. And that's what I'm saying about services like the health service, and we're talking about speech therapists, nurses, doctors, who cannot communicate,
mm-hmm,
with their patients or clients, and that's a big problem. And what you often have is children interpreting for their parents,
right.
Maybe when there's an illness, or you know, it's not appropriate. You know,
right.
It's not a professional.
Yeah.
It's not appropriate. And there is we don't have interpretation services, for
right.
example. We have an attempt at them, but we don't have that. And it is a big problem, and it's still a problem.
So, Trace, would it be fair to say then that during the years of the Celtic Tiger, like when there's a rising tide, in an awful lot of ways, people can say, well, everyone gets carried up with it. So some of the social problems like that may not be as evident or are compensated for because it's a rising tide. But as soon as the tide starts to go out, then they become a lot more apparent, and there is the consequences are also a lot more apparent.
Yeah, one issue that comes to mind is worker exploitation, for example, and that was a huge issue always up along, you know, during the boom years.
Right.
But that's become even more evident now with the Celtic, with the fall, and things are very bad in Ireland at
mm-hmm.
the moment. And
mm-hmm.
in a county like Mayo, things are really bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've 1 in 4 young people unemployed. It's really bad. But what was very evident very quickly was that migrants, I mean, and you'd know this from the Canadian experience, immigrants tend to be in the short term, you know, they're the ones that lose their jobs first.
Mm-hmm.
So they become the most vulnerable first. Now, some go home, of course they do, because it's a natural thing to do. Most follow the work. But most people have, you know, they've lived here now for 10 years, they have children in schools, you know, this is their home, this is their
mm-hmm.
culture now. And, you know, it's too much to uproot themselves and go back to the world they don't know anymore. So they're going to stay here, and many are staying here, but they are in very difficult situations, and in relation to worker exploitation as well as lots of other issues. But in that issue in particular, we're getting very serious cases coming in now
mm-hmm.
because people are very, very vulnerable. If they lose their job, they, you know, they're afraid to complain, they're afraid
right.
to get help, and also a lot are dependent on, you know, work permits are,
right.
you know, and
right.
that's an issue too. So people are trapped as well. You know.
Now, I was watching O'Gorman on RTE recently, and he was in Ballyhaunas. Of course, Ballyhaunas has been a multicultural community for probably longer than any other community in Ireland.
Yeah.
And it was quite fascinating because it would appear as if integration successfully happened and has successfully happened in Ballyhaunas because of that, because of course Halal came in there. That would have been gone back into even the late 70s.
Yeah, to the 70s, yeah.
So there's quite a strong ethnic diversity.
There is, yeah.
And it was fascinating. There was one guy, and he was talking about life in Ireland as an immigrant, and he had full Mayo accent. There was no trace of being an immigrant in that sense.
Yeah. Like Ballyhaunas is... There was a recent, I think it was 3 years ago, the local school actually did a survey, and 35%, within the town boundary, 35% of people were born outside Ireland. And that's because you also have an asylum-seeking hostel in Ballyhaunas.
Okay.
So that's what I'm saying. You have a small, Ballyhaunas is a small country rural town.
Yeah.
You have a hostel with 350 asylum seekers.
Right.
And... you know, things are difficult for them there because they can't work, you know, they can't access education, so they're just living in a limbo for years. But in Ballyhaunas you have, as you said, you have a strong Pakistani, Syrian community. There's a strong Muslim community, and
yes.
very well integrated, in particular the Muslim community, actually, in Ballyhaunas. And there's a mosque in Ballyhaunas. The first mosque in Ireland was in
yes,
Ballyhaunas.
Yes, I noticed that.
And, you know, Ballyhaunas is an interesting place, but there are problems in Ballyhaunas, in particular... You know, everything isn't rosy in Ballyhaunas.
I wouldn't expect it is. Trace, we'll take another break. How about if we have a bit of the Saw Doctors and the Green and Red?
Green and Red of Mayo.
You are listening.
Mayo Abu.
You are listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM, and we'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Oh, the Green and Red of Mayo. I can see it still. It's soft and craggy boglands, it's tall majestic hills, where the ocean kisses Ireland, and the waves caress its shore. Oh, the feeling it came over me, stay forevermore. peak, where one Sunday every summer the pilgrims climbed the reek, where St. Patrick in its solitude looked down across the bay, and with the ringing of his bell called the faithful there to pray.
Welcome back to the Gaelic Hour here on 97.9 FM. We're chatting with Therese Ryan. Therese is visiting from Castlebar, and we've been talking about the Gaelfifth, and we were then talking about the changes that occurred in Ireland over the last, particularly during this period of the Celtic Tiger, and the influx of immigrants and how Ireland's, the face of Ireland has changed. But we all know that certainly since about 2007, 2008 particularly, Ireland has changed again, and the economy has taken a nosedive, and the consequences are rather severe, to the extent that many of the immigrants have left, and the Irish are now on the immigration trail again. But one of the major problems that is evident in Ireland, and a lot of effort is being made to try and solve, is that of what are being referred to as ghost estates. And this is the result of a housing development boom, where houses were being built on the basis if we build they will come. Therese, Mayo was not immune from this.
Absolutely not. No, and I think any of your listeners, if they travel home to Ireland now and haven't been in Ireland for a number of years, get quite a shock. You've small villages and these big housing estates, just on the outskirts of villages, and nobody living in them.
Yeah, when we were home recently, it was up in Leitrim.
Yeah.
The village of Leitrim, and I couldn't believe it. And then a few other places, like literally, well, we're crossroads, and you're looking around, and there's housing estates, and there's nobody there.
No, there's nobody there. And what's very unfortunate, I suppose, is for people who bought at the peak of the Celtic Tiger, and what we're talking about, young people, who were given 110% mortgages, well, 100% anyway, to buy houses at exorbitant prices that were way over, what they're worth, and now they're left stranded in unfinished estates.
Yeah.
So their estates are they're a building site, and they're left with their house, and living that can't afford the mortgage, And it's a complete, it's a real mess. And what you have is developers now. So many developers have gone out of business, so they've no recourse.
Right.
So housing estates are just left unfinished. And then the council, for example, what would be normal protocol in a town like Castlebar or anywhere else, is that the council would take over an estate once the builder has completed a snag list that the housing estate mm-hmm. is complete. Whereas the council cannot take over an estate if it's not finished.
Right.
So it's a limbo situation, and people, you know, people are very, it's very unfair and it's very unjust.
Now, while the empty houses are a reflection of what has happened, prior to the bust, a lot of government funds were coming from a property boom that was literally each brick being built on the brick before without any necessary foundation. And as a result of the bust, revenues have dried up, and we're seeing that Ireland is now spending something like 20 billion a year over its revenues. And I noticed a piece on the internet in the last few days which said it was the most indebted country in the world. As a politician at a local level, in touch and working with the community, this has to translate down from what we read in the headlines in the paper and what we hear from government ministers or media commentators to the man on the street.
Absolutely.
How is the man on the street affected?
Well, first of all, debt. Personal debt. So people are stuck, as I said, with massive mortgages. They cannot afford repayments. They can't afford the interest on the repayments. They've lost their jobs. They're stuck with this debt, and they're really suffering. So, I mean, there's so many housing repossessions now,
right,
as well. So that's one thing.
Would that be below a certain age? And I would say that from the point of view of if somebody, for example, is in their 50s, the chances are they had bought their house, they were settled, and they had a relatively small mortgage. So there must be a section of the population that are, I won't quite say immune, but
they're not immune because they're depending on services.
Okay.
So for example, our hospital service, our health service is falling asunder.
Right.
It's cracking at the seams. It's not functioning. So, for example, anybody on a temporary contract has been let go. It doesn't matter what position they have. It doesn't matter if they're a nurse in the emergency ward. They've been let go. And there's a staff embargo. So you cannot employ any new staff. So essential services cannot be delivered on. So you've wards closing down, you've clinics closing down, you've A&E, which is accident and emergency,
mm-hmm.
are closing down. And it's just falling apart. Our education system is falling apart. We have the highest pupil-teacher ratios in Europe. We have, and it's all our disability. So access to, our supports for people, children with disabilities, for adults with disabilities, of all, right across the spectrum, those supports have been cut. And I suppose that's what I find very, very difficult, is that it's always the most vulnerable. It's always the essential services that are cut first.
But is that the nature of government? And not to get into any kind of a party political debate, but more a kind of high-level economic debate in one sense, which is to say that the role of government, in a way, is to fund services that are essential services. And if government runs out of money, logically, what they've been funding is what's going to suffer. Whether it's right or wrong, government doesn't need to fund services like memberships to a golf club. What they're funding are essential. So of its nature, when money dries up, that's what gets hit.
Yeah, I suppose from my point of view, it's the vulnerable that are suffering all the time. And it's, for example, staff that for wage cuts, for example. There was a very interesting, which I found quite shocking, is we were civil servants working in the public service. There was a recent statistic that just came out just before I came over a few weeks ago, that over 3,000 people, and that mightn't sound many in Canada, but in Ireland that's a lot, it's a good percentage of our public service,
mm-hmm.
Over 3,000 people are dependent. They have to go out to work every day, they earn a weekly wage, they have a full-time job, but they're dependent on social welfare to keep them living above the poverty line.
Okay.
And yet the government are coming in cutting the lower paid all the time, and I know why you don't want to get into political things, but they're cutting the lower pay instead of going for the middle management.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody knows we're in a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know we have to pull together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no shortcuts, there's no short answers. We
no.
have squandered this. You know, this is, there's been, it's shocking what has happened in Ireland in the last 10 years. But it needs to be fair. And it needs to be seen that it's equitable and that it's not always the vulnerable and the people with the disability, lone parents, you know, people in social welfare, that they're always the first to go and that are essential services.
Now,
there's a whole layer in the health service of middle management.
I know, but the difficulty with anything like that is if you cut middle management, even cut pay and middle management, what you're doing, and again, this is not to get into it, but you're potentially cutting disposable income, which potentially is what might revitalise your economy.
But I'll just the argument for that is, if you cut somebody who's on minimum wage, if you cut somebody, a low income earner spends their money directly in the economy that week, a higher income puts it into a pension or goes on a holiday.
Right.
So you'll actually stimulate, I think that's a fault, you'll stimulate the economy. You know, you want people to spend their money.
Agreed.
So by cutting lower pay, you know, they've no money to spend, but yet they're not surviving.
Yeah.
But the other thing, just very quickly, because I feel strongly about this in Mayo, is we have one in four people unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed in a hostel in Toronto when I came over here for the first two nights, and it's full of Irish people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed, and I was sitting there going, this place, it's full of Irish people. And they're young Irish people who are emigrating.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we have unemployment now of nearly 500,000. It's nearly up in 500,000, which is, it's the highest it's ever been, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, and I mean, unemployment and that whole wave of emigration, forced emigration, is happening again, and I find that quite scary, particularly in a county like Mayo.
And as you say, I know that in Toronto particularly, they're getting an influx. While we're getting some immigrants here in Ottawa, it's nothing like what is going into Toronto. And the Ireland Canada Chamber in Toronto held an information night back in June, and there was over 120 young guys turned up.
Yeah.
And of course here in Ottawa, we have now established a chapter of the Ireland Canada Chamber also. And these are some of the initiatives that we want to make sure that we're here to support.
Yeah, I think that's really important because this also is a generation who haven't been used. They're used to having everything.
That's right.
They've had everything they need. Full education. They're highly qualified. And you know, I could see people falling through the cracks.
Yeah.
You know, as time goes on. But and I think it's very important that you support people while they're abroad.
Trez, we're going to wrap up. But before we do, I'm going to refer back to a program I did a number of weeks ago when I had the opportunity to visit Castlebar and meet Clodagh Doyle at the Museum of Country Life. Wonderful facility you have in your town there.
Absolutely. I have to say, it's in Tyrla, just outside, about three miles outside Castlebar. And it's such an addition to Tyrla, to Castlebar, to Mayo, to the Western region.
Yeah.
And it's been a phenomenal success. I mean, it's the only, it's the first, well, there's one in Dangan and everything, but it's one of the only the National Museums in Dublin, like, and this is the first to be brought outside Dublin. And as you see, you've seen it, it's on beautiful grounds.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful, beautiful place. But what's really impressive about the museum is that they do wonderful outreach programs as well. And so, for example, Mayo Intercultural Action, we've teamed up with them on a number of occasions.
Right.
And we've done projects working with migrants and the local community, you know, joint projects, and then come up with that has been displayed in the museum and put on permanent record there. And they're wonderful to work with, and it's such a resource to Castlebar and to the community.
The Cross of Conn is there at the moment.
Absolutely.
And the week we were there, we just missed the big festival weekend.
Failing it too, yeah. I have to say, if you're ever in Castlebar for the May, it's the Maybank Holiday weekend.
It's a wonderful
event. It's such a family, and they've had good weather every year so far. So, no, it's wonderful.
Well, Trez Rann, I want to thank you for taking the time and coming on the Gaelic Hour and sharing some of your experiences here on your Canadian visit and some of your what you work on in Ireland, and it was a pleasure having you on the show.
It was such a pleasure to be here in Ottawa and in Canada, and I look forward to coming back. Chapter Asherif.